Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Old Magic of Christmas, Yuletide Traditions for the Darkest Days of the Year, by Linda Radish, narrated by Chloe Cannon. Listen, we are beginning our story. When we arrive at the end of it, we shall, it is to be hoped, know more than we do now. Hans Christian Andersen, The Snow Queen. Note: all direct quotes from The Snow Queen are from my own crumbling, tartan-bound copy of Tales from Hans Andersen, published by Thomas Y. Crowell & Co. in 1897. I suspect it of being an overly flowery Victorian translation, but it is the one to which I am sentimentally attached. Introduction. Christmas, at its heart, is a hazy thing. This book explores the finer points of how it came to be that way, without, it is to be hoped, actually dispelling any of that seductively glittering haze. If you are open to the experience of a deeper and, yes, darker season, if you're not afraid to open the door to the odd ghost or wizened witch, if you would welcome a shiver that has nothing to do with the coming of winter, then you've come to the right place. While this is not a children's book, it was written by a lover of fairy tales, and you will find scattered references to Hans Christian Andersen, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, and a few others you might not immediately associate with Christmas. Meandering throughout are references to my favorite children's story of all, The Snow Queen, in which the courageous young Gerda makes her way, sometimes barefoot, from an attic apartment in Denmark to a witch's garden, a robber's camp, and on through Lapland to the snow saloon at the heart of the Snow Queen's stronghold to effect the spiritual rescue of her playmate, Kay. The Snow Queen is not, strictly speaking, a Christmas story, but the lands through which Gerda passes are in many cases the same lands through which the ancient Yuletide goddess has also passed with her retinue of fairies, ghosts, and goblins. You don't have to be Christian to fall in love with the Christmas season. We've all seen those stickers urging us to keep the Christ in Christmas. I choose to interpret these in the most positive of lights, as a call to Christians to use the season as a means of more deeply exploring their faith. Pagans can do the same. Despite what you may have heard, the old gods and goddesses are not so easy to pick out in our modern festivities, but what a joy it is when you do spy one of them hanging around the punch bowl or riding in with the mistletoe. Such a lengthy season demands a cast of thousands, and witches, trolls, and household sprites all have their parts to play. In these pages you will find elves aplenty, both light elves, such as might be expected to have taken up employment as toymakers under the swaying curtain of the northern lights, and dark elves, who lurk in the forest, hiding their faces from the sun. I propose that Yule, and the days leading up to it, is the best time to contrast our more recent conception of these earthbound spirits with the more interactive relationship our ancestors had with them in the past. There is a popular belief among both pagans and non-pagans that Christmas as we know it is essentially a pagan celebration, its rituals the richly dressed attempts of primal people to rekindle the dying embers of the sun. Though this is a fine mythology in itself, it's really only half the story. Some of the creatures you're about to meet are unabashedly heathen, while others are the products of highly Christianized imaginations. The vast majority are some combination of the two. As you turn the pages of this book, I would like you to feel as if you are forcing open an ancient church door to find not dusty pews, but an old-growth forest, moonlight glancing off the holly leaves as gauzy spirits dart among the boughs. I hope you, the reader, will be as surprised as I was at some of the discoveries I have made in the course of my own journey through this forest. At first glance, the Swedish Lucia, with her crown of lights and blood-red sash, is a shoo-in for an ancient personification of, or sacrifice to, the sun. But this turns out not to be the case. On St. Lucy's Day, you may also be surprised by what you find under the Bohemian Lucy's skirts. Conversely, the Italian witch Befana, whose name means Epiphany, and whose story is inextricably bound up with that of the three kings who brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the baby Jesus, owes her existence as much to a Germanic goddess as to the Book of Matthew. There is no denying that Christmas is and always has been largely about the choosing, buying, wrapping, and presentation of gifts. The Roman Saturnalia, an early precursor of our own holiday, was marked by the exchange of candles, little clay dolls, and other trinkets. Gift-giving is, after all, an expression of goodwill, especially when you are handing a little of your hard-earned cash back down the socioeconomic ladder. No, you don't have to make merry, but you ought to take the time to remember that we are all, as Scrooge's nephew attempted to explain to his uncle, fellow passengers to the grave, and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. Which brings us, naturally, to the three Christmas ghosts familiar to the whole world, those of past, present, and yet to come. A Christmas Carol was neither the first nor the last Christmas ghost story Charles Dickens wrote, nor did he invent the genre. He brought an already established storytelling tradition to new heights. Christmas and the spirit world were so closely linked in Dickens's imagination that he saved up his spookiest ideas for publication in December. In the forging of our own bright, shiny American Christmas, certain attitudes, beliefs, and practices have been clipped away, for that is the nature of tradition. Some customs might survive for centuries, while others bite the dust under the Christmas tree skirt almost as soon as they are born. Rather than let those old clippings lie in a heap on Santa's workshop floor, I have gathered a handful of them up and held their rough edges to the light. Take a look. While I cannot with any confidence promise you a Merry Christmas, I can offer you the prospect of a very interesting one. Many of you may be of the opinion that Christmas is all about the kids. I disagree. Christmas is all about safely scaring the kids, and sometimes ourselves, in the process. The Christmas season used to stretch all the way from late October to February 2nd. It should be noted that while the broom-toting Barborki appear predictably on St. Barbara's Eve, December 3rd, and La Befana can be counted on to sweep through the sky with her sack of toys on Epiphany Eve, January 5th, there are few hard and fast rules when it comes to the order of this otherworldly procession. If I have placed a certain occurrence in a certain province on Christmas Eve, it does not mean that a similar ritual might not take place on New Year's Eve, or Twelfth Night, somewhere else. In the early Middle Ages, the Christmas season was reckoned to begin on November 1st, but keep in mind that the medieval's November 1st was not our November 1st. Note, the 365-day year with which we are all familiar was invented by Julius Caesar, or someone working for him, in 46 BCE. This is the Julian, or old-style, calendar, because it does not take the Earth exactly 365 days to complete its revolution around the sun. Over the centuries, a sort of seasonal drift occurred that not even the Julian leap year could correct. Finally, in 1582, Pope Gregory XIII, or someone working for him, removed 10 days from the fall of that year and tinkered with the leap year system to create the Gregorian, or New Style, calendar. The Gregorian calendar, which promises many of us a white Christmas each year, was accepted higgledy-piggledy throughout the Western world over a period lasting from 1582 to 1923. This should help explain why December 13th, 21st, and 25th have all been hailed at one time as the date of the winter solstice. When you also take into account the ecclesiastical calendar, the landlord's calendar, the old Icelandic calendar, and the lunar calendar to which Easter obstinately clings, It's a wonder that there is any consensus at all when it comes to our modern holidays. What we now call Halloween was, for the ancient Celts, the night preceding the start of the winter half of the year, and therefore a sort of New Year's Eve, and for the Anglo-Saxons, what we call the beginning of winter was midwinter. As in my first book, Night of the Witches, Folklore, Traditions, and Recipes for Celebrating Walpurgis Night, many of the uncanny creatures you'll meet are Germanic in origin, but folk beliefs and traditions, like the people who create them, often flow smoothly one into another, instead of falling into neat scholarly categories. Our journey into Christmas will also take us deep into Celtic, Italic, Baltic, and Slavic lands. With such a wealth of characters on hand, one has to draw the line somewhere, and I have chosen to draw it around the Catholic and formerly Catholic countries of Northern and Central Europe, including, of course, those hotbeds of Christmas creepiness, Iceland and the British Isles. There will also be the odd excursion to North America, though only in relation to Old World practices preserved there. That said, no book of Christmas ghouls would be complete without the Greek kalikansari, who slip uninvited down the chimney to cause havoc on Christmas Eve. Although they belong to the Eastern Orthodox realm, you will find them here too, along with a handful of more northerly Christmas beasts, some naughty, others nice, the odd vampire, and a few unquiet child ghosts. And what is Christmas without at least a sprig of something green? Now more than ever, Christmas is a hothouse holiday. Before the advent of the poinsettia, Christmas cactus, and overblown Yuletide cyclamen, humbler herbs had pride of place in the window, at the altar, and among the decorations in the hall. Along with the holly and the mistletoe, you will encounter some of the more unusual, sometimes haunted, seasonal greens, including ivy, juniper, and black hellebore. Rest assured that there is more to see here than a few green wreaths, quaint witches, and prettily glowing ghosts. Few of the spirits you encounter will make your blood run cold, for the aim of this book is to capture the mystery of Christmas, not to evoke full-blown horror. Still, once you've read this book, you'll no longer dismiss that drumming on the rooftop as reindeer hooves. When you hear tinkling bells and a gruff ho-ho, you'll be looking out for the Wild Hunt instead of Santa's sleigh. And as soon as you turn your calendar page to December, you'll be on the alert for the thump of a broom, the rustle of straw, or the brushing of birch twigs against the window pane. Just as this continually evolving thing we call Christmas did not used to end on December 25th, this book does not end at the conclusion. At the back, you will find a calendar of Christmas spirits and spells to help you both organize and extend your festivities. There you will find the whole season at a glance, as well as a few extra otherworldly tidbits not found elsewhere in the book. In the glossary, I have defined terms not elucidated in the text. These range from familiar words whose exact meanings might nevertheless escape the reader, such as distaff and flu, to terms with which the reader may not be familiar at all, such as primstav and ember days. The glossary is also the receptacle of my less pertinent musings, which I have withheld from the main text, in order not to break the flow. Chapter 1. A Thousand Years of Winter. If you speak English, then you are used to dedicating your Thursdays to the Germanic god Thor, because the gnome-like Nissa and Tomtin who watched over Nordic farmsteads refused to work on Thursday nights. We might jump to the conclusion that they were devotees of the thunder god. Thor's was always a popular cult, so it is possible that the wizened old fellows were his men. But first we should take a look at how the Norse, German, and Anglo-Saxon peoples reckoned their days. Just as all Jewish holidays begin at sundown before the day they are marked on the calendar, Germanic pagans counted their days from dusk to dusk, instead of from daybreak to daybreak. which is why many, if not most, of the witches, ghosts, and goblins in this book fetch up in the darkness, preceding each saint's feast day. As soon as darkness has fallen on Thursday, Thor's Day, we enter Friday Eve, or, in the Germanic pagan imagination, Frigga's Eve. Frigga, who dwelt among the other sky gods in Asgard, was queen to Odin's king. She was a little less promiscuous than the fertility goddess Freya, and decidedly more interested in housekeeping, especially the production of cloth. This is not to say that Frigga and Freya were not two faces of the same goddess, which is also a distinct possibility. Frigga was present in the northern sky in the form of her distaff, a constellation more familiar to us moderns as Orion's Belt. Spinning was forbidden on Frigga's Eve. An empty distaff next to a basket of full spools demonstrated to the goddess that you were a diligent sort and could afford, like the Nissa and Tomtin, to slack off for one night. But by Twelfth Night, January 6th, you had better have spun all the wool and flax in the house, for when the Christmas season was over, it would be time to set up the big upright loom, at which time you must have enough thread to warp it and start your weaving. In Alpine lands, Frigga was known as Perkta, Berkta, or Berta, and her cult continued to flourish long after the belief in goddesses had been swept under the straw. To make it clear that she no longer claims deity status, she now often goes by Frau, meaning Mrs. She has also been called Spinnstubenfrau, or Spinning Room Lady. In Scandinavia, the icy twinkling of Frigga's distaff in the night sky was enough to keep the maids busy as bees. But elsewhere, young spinners had to be reminded that the last thing the goddess wanted to see when she peered in the window at Epiphany was a cloud of unspun wool or flax languishing on the distaff. In Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, there were numerous tales of Frau Berkta trampling and even setting fire to the half-spun fibers. Though few of us do our own spinning these days, the last three Thursdays preceding Christmas still belong to Frau Berkta. She does not always put in an appearance on these Berktel nights, as they are known in parts of the Alps. She has servants for that. Mostly these servants make a racket. Bavarian children, appointing themselves temporarily to Frau Berkta's service, used to run around throwing dry peas, beans and pebbles against the doors and windows to remind everyone that Christmas was coming. Because of the noise, these Thursdays were known in Germany as the knocking nights. Homeowners rewarded the children for driving the evil spirits out from under the eaves. If the children happened to disturb any witches in the process, they did not fear pursuit, for the witch would be compelled to stop and count all of the beans that had fallen in her dooryard before she could go after the perpetrators. The white bees are swarming. In the Snow Queen, when fat white snowflakes are swirling outside the window, the old grandmother tells Kay and Gerda, "Those are the white bees swarming there." Later, Kay spots the queen bee herself as she alights on the rim of an empty flower pot as a lady dressed in the finest white crepe, composed of millions of star-like particles. Although there was no Frau Berkta afoot in Andersen's Denmark, the writer had traveled extensively through Europe, including the Alpine hinterlands where Berkta's larger servants still come to collect tribute for their queen bee, as they call her. Though the queen herself is nowhere in sight, her servants present themselves dutifully at the farmer's gate in grotesquely carved wooden masks. They remind the farmer that it is Frau Berkta who blankets the fields in snow so the soil can rest and yield generous crops next year. The farmer had better make an offering to these worker bees if he wants them to come back and dance in the fields at the close of winter and bless the furrows. On Berktel nights, the goddess's Austrian servants take to the streets and create a din by ringing cowbells and playing tuneless music on their fiddles. These activities were not always confined to Advent Thursdays or to Austria. A fortnight before St. Andrew's Day, November 30th, 1572, One Hans Buchmann claimed that he had been transported by supernatural agency from the forest near Rothenburg, Germany, to Milan, Italy. When he was first set upon, he thought he was under attack by a swarm of bees, but the buzzing then resolved itself into a terrifying scraping of bows on fiddle strings. We don't know what really happened to Hans. Just before his disappearance, he had borrowed some money without asking, so he had plenty of reason to fabricate the tale. But it is interesting that he should have thought to mention how the buzzing of bees had preceded his being lifted up and carried over the treetops. After that, he had to make his own way back to Rothenburg, finally arriving on Candlemas, February 2nd. In the Alps of the same century, a visit from the Zalige Fräuleins, blessed young ladies, who came at night to sample food offerings left on the table, was announced by a softer bee-like music than the one Hans Buchmann heard. These blessed ones, as they are also called, would eventually make themselves over as the Christ child's retinue and replace the humming with the tinkling of a tiny clapper bell. Still, wherever Berchta is remembered under her own name, we can expect to hear buzzing strings, or at least some allusion to bees. A bird's eye view. Also running amok was Berchta's more northerly incarnation, Frau Holle, who used to take charge of all infants who died before they could be baptized. The stubbled fields over which the broomstick-mounted Frau Holle and her adopted children flew at Christmas time would be especially bountiful at the next harvest. But if you looked up at the flight of spirits as they passed overhead, you would be struck blind. Frau Holle eventually lost her sacred season in the north, but thanks to the Brothers Grimm, she is remembered in fairy tale. Frau Holle is the stereotypical German Hausfrau. The snow is the goose down that swirls into the sky when she shakes out her voluminous feather bed. The fog is the steam wafting up from the pots on her stove, and the thunder is the turning of her flax reel. Frau Holle was always looking for good help. To apply for the maid's position in her house, you first had to pass through water, either the pool in which she bathed to make herself young again, or an ordinary well. In the Grimm's fairy tale, Frau Holle, an industrious though apparently clumsy girl drops her spindle down a well. Naturally, she goes in after it, emerging in a wonderful land full of flowers and sunshine. She wanders aimlessly, helping out a loaf of bread about to burn and a drooping apple tree along the way. Finally arriving at a cottage, she is greeted by a long-toothed old woman who introduces herself as Frau Holle and offers her a place in the household. The girl stays on to cook, clean, and help shake out the feather beds until she grows homesick. Frau Holle releases her without complaint, showering her with gold coins as she steps out the door. Later, the girl's lazy stepsister dives down into the same well to see what she can get out of the old woman. She ignores both the imperiled loaf of bread and the apple tree, and when she gets to the cottage, she does little more than trail her fingers over the dusty furniture and swat half-heartedly at the bedclothes. When she announces that she is quitting, she gets a bucket of pitch dumped over her head. While the German Frau Holle has been known to let herself go, her lack of youthful bloom is nothing compared to the horror that is Berchta. The Alpine Berchta is the image of Frau Holle as it might appear in that devilish, distorting mirror with which Andersen opens the Snow Queen. The name Berchta dates back to the 14th century, while the first written reference to a horrible witch who presided over the winter festivities comes from Salzburg in the 10th. Who knows how long she might have been around before that? Of course, she may not always have gone by the name of Berchta. Jacob Grimm offers us the possibility that her name may have come from Old High German, Gipirata Nacht, or Shining Night. That is, Epiphany, January 6th, the night on which the star shone down on Bethlehem. The fact that the old witch still has her own Berchtentag, or Berchta's Day, on January 6th, and that she is celebrated through all the 12 days of Christmas with the Berchtenlauf, or running of Perchta's servants, is a major accomplishment. Yes, Perchta does have a pretty side, which is embodied by the pretty Perchten, who array themselves in flowery, cone-shaped headdresses, but most of her votaries appear as hairy, horned monsters, their huge mouths carved into grimaces. These evil Perchten are not just ugly, but rowdy, too. One of their jobs is to climb up on the village rooftops and drop snowballs down the chimneys. How has Perchta managed to last so long? Certainly not by being pretty or nice. One of the secrets of her longevity may be her willingness to poke her long nose into other people's business, as we will see her doing on St. Barbara's and St. Lucy's Eve in Chapter 9. Since the 15th century, at least, Perchta has been portrayed with an inhumanly long nose, sometimes described as iron-nosed. Her Austrian nickname, Schnabelpercht, Beak Perchta, is more apt. Perchta was also supposed to have one splayed foot, ostensibly from pressing the treadle of her spinning wheel, but more likely to have been a goose or swan's foot. These avian vestiges, along with the white feathers that Frau Holle caused to fall from the sky, suggest that Perchta was used to assuming the shape of a bird, an ancient habit of Germanic goddesses like Frigga and Freya. House calls. Another strategy for holding on to power is to keep a close eye on one's subjects. Accordingly, the irrepressible old hag used to visit homes personally on the eve of Epiphany, January 5th. If she liked what she found, the German Berchta might leave a gift on her own sky-spun yarn as a token of her approval. If this Yuletide goddess didn't like what she saw, then you had better beware. When she stepped over the threshold, she might be carrying a bundle of twigs, straw, or brushwood in one of her withered claws. Was she thinking of doing a little extra sweeping with that bundle of twigs? Or had she brought kindling for the fire? She might also be holding a brick, so perhaps she'd come to fix that chink in the garden wall. Unfortunately, it was none of those. Once she'd run her talon over the tops of the cupboards and counted the full spools of thread, the old biddy would want to know what you had made for supper, and whether or not you remembered to put a little aside for her. She had better not smell any meat through that long beak of a nose, because the eve of Epiphany meant a brief reinstitution of the penitential fast that preceded Christmas. On this night, as the initials of the three kings were being chalked upon the lintel, the only permissible foods were fish and starch. Oatmeal, with a little smoked herring on the side, was one way to go, as was a thin pancake made of only flour and milk. Dumplings were a tastier solution. In the Thuringian forest of central Germany, Frau Holle was credited with the original potato dumpling recipe from which all others descend, while in Braunschweig, to the north, she insisted only that no beans be eaten during the 12 days of Christmas. But what if you forgot and went out for beer and sausages just before the old lady arrived? Or if you cooked the right dishes but forgot to leave an extra portion warming on the stove? The consequences would not be quite the same as if you had neglected to put out cookies for Santa, for Frau Berchta would be really, horribly upset. First, she would slit open your belly with the knife she kept hidden in her skirts. Then she would reach in and pull out all that forbidden food, replacing it with the bundle of kindling, or that brick, before she sewed you up again using farm implements instead of surgical instruments. She wouldn't do any of this right away, but would wait until you were sleeping. In the Icelandic Laxdæla saga, On the Black, Smith to Olaf Höskuldsson undergoes the same procedure not once, but twice. In Chapter 48, On dreams that a hag is standing over him with a meat cleaver and a wooden trough. Without a word, she cuts him open, scoops out his entrails, and stuffs him full of twigs. Was it something he ate? Scrooge might have said so, for did he not try to dismiss Marley's ghost as an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of underdone potato? When An relates his experience at breakfast the next morning, the other men tease him, but his hostess interprets the vision as a warning. Sure enough, in the next chapter, An and his traveling
sample complete. Ready to continue?